This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 20 years ago this morning, a grim fortification divided the city of Berlin and stood as a symbol of the Cold War itself. On that November 9th, an East German official responded to the movement of hundreds of thousands of people across other Iron Curtain borders and said there would be looser restrictions in East Germany, too. When? Reporters asked. Immediately, he said. Once the news got out, crowds swelled to checkpoints, and at around 11 p.m. local time, befuddled border guards started to let them cross to the west, first one at a time, then in an uncontrollable torrent. They greeted relatives and friends, greeted strangers as friends. The celebration became an indelible moment and an unstoppable force, and one that brought about incredible change. This hour, we'll talk with people who were there when the wall fell, who've considered its significance, with a photographer, an American diplomat, a newspaper editor, a German writer, President George H.W. Bush's chief of staff, and with you. Tell us your story. If you were there, what do you remember? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. You can click on Talk of the Nation. We'll also take questions from an audience with us here in Studio 4A. And thanks to you all very much for coming in today. Appreciate it. We begin with New Hampshire. Peter Schneider is a well-known German writer and a former leader of the student protest movement in Berlin. He's kind enough to join us today from our bureau in New York. And Peter Schneider, nice to have you with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Hello. Glad I'm be here.
And I said New Hampshire because that's where you were on this day 20 years ago.
That's right. That is the only invitation I ever felt sorry about that I accepted to the United States. No, actually, I had predicted the fall of the wall, but I didn't trust my predictions, of course. Writers are not so confident as politicians are. Anyway, so I was working in my office, actually rewriting an article for the New York Times that was called If the Wall Came Tumbling Down, Somebody Sticks in His Head and Says, Did you hear? The wall is open. The Trabi cars are vandalizing Kurfürstendamm. And I said, no, this is crazy. I don't believe your word. And then I started to believe it, and I must confess to a very egotistical moment. I said, my God, couldn't they wait until I have finished my article?
History rarely is that cooperative. The Trabis you talked about were the Trabant cars
made in East
Germany that were... Well, they did not compare with Rolls Royces, let's put it that way.
That's for sure. They were out of plastic.
Yes. And, well, in that way, anticipating many of the cars that would come in the future, though, not quite so well engineered. Anyway, I'm sure you got back there as soon as you could. What was it like when you arrived at the site of the wall in Berlin?
Exactly. I as soon as I could, I went back to Berlin and... I took the chance to ask everybody I met, how did you live November 9th? And I collected these extraordinary stories in a reportage that was later on published. And I remember many of these wonderful accounts that were given to me. For instance, there was this East German who had checked out a book from the American Memorial Library, which of course was in West Berlin, and he could never return the book because the wall was constructed the next day.
Those when fines have mounted up.
Right. when it came down 20 years after, the first thing the good old German did was to return the book.
So those fines didn't mount up. A compound interest is not returned to get him. Let's talk now with somebody who was there. Stay with us, Peter, if you would.
Yeah.
This is Carol Guzzi, who's a photographer, staff photographer for The Washington Post, and was in Berlin that day. And she's been kind enough to join us here in Studio 4A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. It's an honor.
As you were you there ready to photograph the fall of the wall? What brought you to Berlin that day?
Yeah, well, I actually had been there previously covering the story, and mistakenly thought there would be enough of a lull to come home because I was weary. And then all of a sudden, boom, the wall was coming down. My colleague and I, Rich Lipsky, got back on a plane and flew for the first day that they were taking out the first chunk of the wall.
And that must have been an extraordinary scene.
It's something that certainly stirs your soul. It's the most profoundly poignant story I think I've ever covered, both as a journalist and just on a personal level. It's kind of a wow moment, I call it, where you put the camera down and you just take it all in and you realize that your eyes are witnessing history.
This was a structure that was part of your psyche well before you ever arrived in Berlin. I'm sure it is something that was the symbol of the Cold War. It was something that a lot of us had thought was achieved the level of permanence.
Exactly, yes. So it was astonishing and remarkable that the wall came down, and so symbolic. When I was there, though, actually for the first day, I was in this crushing crowd and I couldn't see a thing. And one of the pesky problems about photography is you have to actually see your subject. So I looked around and saw this very large, sturdy German tripod staring at me. And he was very gracious and put me on his shoulders and spent probably the most memorable moment of his life with my Nikons clanking around on his forehead.
You can see some of Carol Guzy's pictures of Carol Guzy that day at our website. Go to npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go now to somebody else who was there. And Congressman Joe Crowley, a Democrat from New York, has called into the program. Nice of you to join us today.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And what were you doing in Berlin?
Well, I actually started out in London. I was rekindling an old friendship and was on the way back from Cambridge back to London when we heard on the radio that was going on. And all of us at once decided we were going to go to Berlin, but only two of us woke up early enough the next morning to catch the 5:30 flight with a bunch of journalists and photographers. And we, via Frankfurt, we landed in Berlin and I met two guys from Senator Pete Wilson's office. We didn't know who they were. We struck up a little accord with them, and we all four of us got a hotel room, threw our bags in about three blocks from the wall. I'd never been to Berlin before. I walked down to the wall. I was in cowboy boots and a leather jacket, and someone handed me a sledgehammer. I just started swinging away. I was in the state legislature at the time, and I was 27 years old at the time, and it was just like a real surreal moment, not really knowing what would happen or what the consequences of hitting the wall would be, but there were just throngs of people at the time and excitement. And I ran into a reporter from CBS Radio, News Radio 88. She just happened to recognize me. She says, "I know you." And I said, "I'm Joe Crowley. You're Assemblyman Crowley." I said, "Yes." And she stuck a microphone in front of me, and that's how my parents and my family found out I was in Berlin.
So you give us 22 minutes, we'll give you a change in history.
Yeah.
Peter Schneider, let's go back to you for just a moment. This is not where you grew up necessarily, but this was something that was far more personal to any German than it was to any American.
Well, yes. It was very different for West Germans and East Germans. I mean, the East Germans, for them it was the ultimate border which could never be crossed. And it really felt like when they came, it felt like prisoners who came out of the prison and were free from one moment to the other. We in West Berlin, especially the ones in West Germany who didn't really see and feel the wall, it was different then. We got kind of familiar. I once wrote, you know, the wall for me was after a while only a reason to change direction with my car.
Well, soon you would be able to drive right through where
right.
It used to be.
By the way, it took a long time. Once you got used to all these stupid ways to go around the checkpoint and so forth and on, once you have used all these different ways where you were allowed to go, it took me like 10 years to go straight forward.
Now let's get a caller in on the line, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And we're having a little difficulty with our technology here, and we'll get that straightened out in the next break. But anyway, let's go back to Congressman Crowley. Congressman, when you were there, there was sort of a moment of infection, the giddiness that everybody's talking about. Carol was talking about it too.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, there are moments when you have to say, "Oh, my gosh, this is going to change everything."
Well, you know, I distinctly recall deciding amongst all of us, we would go into East Berlin. We tried to get into East Berlin, and we went up through Checkpoint Charlie, the infamous or famous Checkpoint Charlie, and waiting in line. And at the time, I was all nervous because I had a prescription drug on me, and I thought that maybe I might be, you know, you didn't know what the consequences of anything would be. And, you know, I went through anyway, and you could see the stark difference between both sides. I remember walking through and seeing an outdated playground for kids. Everything was rusty and everything was kind of stale. We were really hungry, and we saw what looked like a restaurant. They had outside in the window cakes, and I said, boy, that looked good, and got inside, and the cake was terrible. It just reminded me, it was so bland. It was like the country, it was that part of the country we're in. And then going back into East, into West Berlin that night, and the party atmosphere was like, it was like New Year's Eve at Times Square, and people just joyous and happy. It was just an incredible moment to think about now.
Well, Congressman Crowley, thanks very much for calling in to share your memory.
Thank you. Great to be
appreciate
on
the time. Congressman Joe Crowley of New York. Here's an email that we got from Pam in Cincinnati, Ohio. My recollection of the Berlin Wall was as a 10-year-old getting ready to deliver the afternoon edition of the newspaper to my neighbors. I'm sure I had no sense of just how big a deal it was, but I do clearly remember looking at the picture of the scene, maybe one of Carol's pictures. It was in color, which was rare then, and knowing this was important. And this from Karen from Wieden in Germany. My husband and I were traveling home from West Berlin through East Germany on the U.S. duty train. Usually we saw very little because all the precautions were taken to keep East German citizens away from the decadent West. But that evening, every train station we went through was burgeoning with people catching trains to the West. Every train we passed was full of people having the party of their life. Once we got home, we could see we'd missed the party. For the next week or so, the air was blue with the smoke from the trabi cars and their two-stroke engines. Again, those Trabants made in East Germany. That from Karen, currently living in Wieden, Germany. Well, were you there? What's your story of the fall of the Berlin Wall? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan, Eyewitness to History. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's 20 years to the day since the Berlin Wall was first breached. A now famous East German press conference announced new oblique travel laws. Within an hour, East Germans were gathering at crossing points. Groups became crowds. Then slowly the trickle became thousands pouring through the crossings from both sides. You can see a history of the Berlin Wall in photographs in a gallery at our website. That's at npr.org. We're reliving stories of that day, stories of jubilation and uncertainty. And we want to hear from you if you were there. Tell us what you remember. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go to a question here from the studio audience in Studio 4A. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Patricia Casey Sutcliffe. I live here in D.C. On the actual day, November 9th, 1989, I was a German major at the University of Redlands in California. But I had spent the summer before that, I'd spent 6 weeks in East Germany at something called a labor camp that was organized by the United States Committee for Friendship with the German Democratic Republic. And I got to spend 3 weeks living and working with people from various parts of the Eastern Bloc, and even got to spend about the last 3 days of my stay, I got to live with an East German family. And I remember when it actually happened, when the wall fell, I had such fresh memories of just having been there and having been led through the various sites to see by East Germans who were approved to do so. They took us up into the Brandenburg Tor and showed us the usual movies to show why the Berlin Wall had to be in place. And I couldn't believe it there in California. I was so far away, and yet I had just been there, and it was amazing to see that. One of the things that was interesting for me was that, especially in those last 3 days with the family, they we're talking about the people who are already escaping over the border from Hungary into Austria. So even in August and in late July when I was there, there was some discussion going on, and people were saying, well, are you going to go? Are you going to go to Hungary? Are you going to go over to Austria? And the family that I was staying with were actually very happy and talked about how they wanted to remain because they had everything that they needed, and kept in touch with them for a little while after after all that happened.
And did they continue to feel that way?
I know that they broke up. That is one thing that I know. So, you know, the pressures of life after the wall came down sort of messed up their marriage in any case. And unfortunately, I didn't stay in touch with them much beyond that.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate that. Peter Schneider, a German novelist who's with us from our bureau in New York, the George M. Roth Distinguished Writer in Residence at Georgetown University. There was a system. You were, in even younger days, one of the student rebels who led protests in 1968, challenged the government of West Germany pretty much. There was a system that was in opposition to it, and the fall of the wall meant the removal of that system.
That's right. It by the way, many I was very much interested in what your participant in the auditorium told us. This couple that broke up, of course, I mean, many people in the GDR felt this was a catastrophe that the wall came down. Most intellectuals on the left in West and in the East Germany, they were not very fond of the unification. They were maybe fond of the coming down of the wall, but not for unification. They thought a greater Germany would be very dangerous. It would be, and especially our neighbors, Mitterrand and Miss Thatcher, they hated the idea of a unification. So the only ones who really went for unification were the men and women from the street in East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it were Helmut Kohl and his...
Helmut Kohl, then the chancellor in Germany.
The vice chancellor, and Father Bush, not to be confused with his son, and Gorbachev and his foreign minister, of course, Shevardnadze. Without these people, we would never have had the unification.
Let's go next to J.D. Bindenagel, now Vice President for Community Government and International Affairs at DePaul University, but at that time, Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, East Germany, and he joins us now from the studios of Deutschland Radio Kultur in Berlin, and good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. I'm delighted to be here.
And what's it like in Berlin today?
It's pouring down rain, and Chancellor Merkel has just gone from the Bornholmerstrasse checkpoint to with Gorbachev and others to the Brandenburg Gate to celebrate.
And in the pouring rain, so I don't think that's going to dampen spirits too much.
It does not dampen the spirits. This is a very exciting anniversary of a very important and exciting event.
Where were you that day, and where were you when you heard the news that people were going through the wall?
Well, that evening I began at a reception in West Berlin at the Aspen Institute, where we had leaders from both East and West Germany, including Honecker's own lawyer, Wolfgang Vogel.
Erich Honecker was the party chairman in East Germany at the time, yeah.
That's correct. And Wolfgang Vogel was the spy exchanging lawyer that he had. Sharansky was his most famous case. And on the way, at the end of the reception, Wolfgang told me that the East German government had decided to change and liberalize its law in order to deal with the pressure of all these people trying to flee and to go to travel. And this was hot news, so I drove quickly to the U.S. Embassy, only to find there that Mr. Schabowski had made his statement, and the news that I had was being announced as we were listening.
That's for the East German official who mistakenly announced this policy was going into effect immediately.
That's right, and he was not speaking very well. He was mumbling, and he didn't know what he was really saying, and he was all over the map, and then he was finally asked a question, and when is this travel law effective? And he said, immediately, immediately, and that unleashed a lot of interest in the journalists who were there, and Tom Brokaw from the United States went back to the Brandenburg Gate and began to announce that the wall was open because he had just heard it directly from Gunther Schabowski, the press spokesman. And we in the U.S. Embassy, of course, were looking for what did the government have to say. Well, they didn't really know. They didn't have anything written. It took us an hour and a half to get a statement from the East German government that you had to have a visa to travel. And East Germans didn't have passports, so it was very hard to get a visa. But we thought, sure enough, they will follow through. They're good, orderly people. They will get visas, and the next day they will be traveling. And so we reported this to the White House and the State Department. We called our friends in West Berlin, the minister at the West Berlin mission of the United States, and the ambassador. And so we felt that we had informed President Bush of the things that were happening. But there were two questions that were outstanding. One was, would the Soviet Union intervene if the guards at the checkpoints decided to defend themselves? And they had a shoot-to-kill order to do that. So we were very careful to make sure that we were on top of all the news that was to come. Then I went home. And on the way home up Schönhauser Allee in East Berlin, I crossed this street called Bornholmerstrasse. And in East Germany, on a Thursday night, it's usually very dark and nothing is ever happening. And I looked down this street and there were Trabant, this plasticized pressed wood, two-stroke Trabi, smoke-belching car parked everywhere, which is very unusual. And then I looked down the street about three or four blocks to the checkpoint itself, and there was a camera on the other side, and people yelling, "Tor auf, open the gate, open the gate." And I thought at that point I knew that something was going to happen. I hoped that it wasn't a shoot-to-kill order being executed, but I knew that seeing the television on the other side, that the television would record what was ever happening. I rushed home, got on the phone, woke up the ambassador, called West Berlin and called the White House again to say, we'd like to revise what we had just said, and things may be happening right now as we're speaking. And sure enough, they broke through Bornholmerstrasse and into the cameras of Spiegel television, which was broadcast around the world, confirming what Gunther Schabowski, the spokesman, had said. You can travel. Announced on television and then seen on television, but not what the East German government wanted to do.
Well, one of the officials who was getting the news from J.D. Bindenagel, then the deputy chief of U.S. mission in East Berlin, was John Sununu, then the White House chief of staff under the first President Bush. And he joins us now on the line from his home in New Hampshire, where he's chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party. And good of you to be with us today.
Well, it's nice to be on.
And we're given the time difference, it was much earlier in the day here in Washington, D.C. Were you a little astounded at this news from Berlin?
Well, no matter how much you prepare and hope for an event like that, when it happens, you're always surprised at the moment. But it was obviously a very positive and pleasant surprise.
And were you worried, as Mr. Bindenagel was telling us, about possible Soviet reaction to this?
Well, there had been a lot of discussion about what could happen if such an event occurred. But to tell you the truth, I think there had been a lot of positive interactions with Gorbachev over the months before that. And I think we felt comfortably that even though there may be strong verbal statements, I think the president, President Bush, and Brent Scowcroft and Jimmy Baker were quite comfortable that this was just part of a sequence of events that had, even though the timing wasn't known, had some level of inevitability over time.
I wonder, in the midst of the, obviously events are happening very fast and you're getting dispatches and trying to keep up with the news, was there a moment that evening when there in the White House, you and the others sat back just for a second and said, you know, it's 50 years, we won?
Well, let me say this, which I think is a very important part of the historical record. George Herbert Walker Bush was really very focused and concerned about not making things difficult for Gorbachev and the Russians as they moved through this process, and not putting it in the context of gloating, which may give Gorbachev some difficulty with his military back in the Soviet Union. And so, frankly, we had been talking so much about trying to maintain that frame of reference in the whole process that we almost talked ourselves into the context that we weren't going to assume it was over till it was over. And And I think if you recall, there was that famous news conference scene in the Oval Office where a reporter from, I believe it was CBS, started berating George Herbert Walker Bush, President Bush, for not being euphoric about the collapse of the wall. And the president was trying to maintain that discipline of creating a perception in a climate which was not one of gloating or we finally won, or rubbing this in, if you will, in the nose of the Soviets and Gorbachev. And so, to tell you the truth, we really didn't believe it was over until it was over. And even though the wall coming down was such a visibly historical event, there was still a whole sequence of things to come afterwards. And concerns about what was going on internally in the Soviet Union and some of the internal pressures. And, you know, we had, following this in the months ahead, we had the aborted coup and all that. So the fears were not unfounded, and we were trying to be as disciplined as we could to respond in a way that helped move it along in a steady pace, constructively, rather than just trying to gloat at each milestone.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the fall of the wall 20 years ago today with Carol Guzzi, a staff photographer for The Washington Post, who was there, J.D. Bindenagel, then the deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, Peter Schneider, a German writer, and with John Sununu, then the White House chief of staff. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And John Sununu, before we let you go, I wanted to ask this email we got from Jim in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Margaret Thatcher's opposition to reunification of Germany has been kept quiet. Any comments on why?
Well, I'm not sure opposition is the right word. I think concern is a more appropriate characterization of Lady Thatcher's position at the time. Great Britain, the United Kingdom, had suffered from an aggressive Germany a couple of times in the early 20th century, World War I, World War II. And so she was not as trustful, perhaps, as the U.S. on this side of the ocean might have been. I think the support of the French for it was surprisingly strong, and over time she was... came around to being more comfortable, particularly when she spent some time talking to Kohl and the rest of the Germans about the process. So, yeah, there was concern, but I think opposition may be too strong a word.
John Sununu, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Sununu, White House Chief of Staff under the first President Bush, now Chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party, with us from his home there. And J.D. Bindenagel, I wanted to get back to you before we let you go, and that is to get some idea. The press of events the next few days in Berlin must have been ferocious.
They certainly were ferocious. There was a lot of uncertainty because at the time of the breach of the wall, John is right. We were very elated to see that there wasn't any shooting, and that fear of Soviet intervention was coupled with Gorbachev's order that we learned later to keep his troops in the barracks. But in the next few days, many things were happening. The first is in the first day, the East Germany tried to establish its rule again into its authority, and they ordered the visa requirement to start at 8 o'clock in the morning on Friday. Then came to 8 o'clock in the morning, and there was chaos at Bornholmerstrasse and the other checkpoints, and they decided it would be noon. At noon, they said Monday. So you could see the power of the government flowing from the seat of government to the street. And that became a concern. But people, as you know, the pace of the revolution was breathtaking, but the Germans were very orderly, and they had rules to follow. They were crossing there were new crossing points. The wall was being opened at many other new places, and people were able to go back and forth. There was the West Germans offered East Germans 100 marks when they came, welcome money. And so there was another push to come into West Germany and West Berlin. But there was a sense of elation and excitement, not one of fear. And the fear had gone away from the East Germans at that moment because they were not arrested, they were not shot, things were happening. But there was a sense that all of the dastardly deeds that the East German government and the secret police had been doing was gone. And this elation.
We'd find out more about them later. But in any case, J.D. Bindenagel, yes. Thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it. J.D. Bindenagel, now the Vice President for Community Government and International Affairs at DePauw University. 20 years ago, was a Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, East Germany, and joined us today from Deutschland Radio Kultur in Berlin. We know a lot of you have called. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Our guests continue to be Carol Guzzi, a staff photographer at The Washington Post, and Peter Schneider, a leading German writer who's with us from our bureau in New York. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Where were you when the wall fell 20 years ago today? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're observing the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Here's an email from Christine in Lithia, Florida. My husband and I were 20-year-old newlyweds in the fall of 89. He was an Army specialist who just received his orders to report for his next duty station, Field Station Berlin, on November 19th, 1989. He was even able to spend New Year's Eve night at the wall, joining East and West Berlin, sledgehammer in hand. We spent the next 3 years in newly free and soon-to-be reunited Germany. Our biggest regret is that after returning to the U.S. as married college students, we soon got tired of lugging around three huge chunks of the Berlin Wall. A landfill somewhere has priceless chunks of concrete. I think we've got our problem solved with our telephone system, and Sven is on the line. Sven calling from Ann Arbor.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Sven.
I'm from East Berlin, so I grew up on the other side of the wall, and I was 17 in 89, and my memory is actually more connected with the summer and early fall of 89, where I was part of the protest movement, organizing demonstrations and handing out leaflets and all that. And so that all came to an end after the wall came down, and then it was just exploring the new West Berlin and finding our way around there. So that was a kind of a change in events on that day, I would say.
It was a day, you were young, I was younger, but we all recognize that history was made that day, no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been working towards that goal of changing the government. November 4 was the 1 million strong demonstration in East Berlin, which challenged the first draft of the travel laws that were put out or put in front of the legislatures there. And I think what then happened on November 9 was the second draft, which Schabowski came out and kind of fumbled the decision as when to start. But it was very historic and very life-changing.
Sven, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
And Peter Schneider, this day, I guess a lot of people saw it coming, that as soon as people started coming across the border in Hungary and various other places, this seemed inevitable that it would happen. Did it seem inevitable to you?
No. And by the way, I think we were very lucky that it happened the way it happened. It could have, the whole thing could have gone just another way. And I think in history, generally, nothing is inevitable. We have thought about so many things. They couldn't stand, they couldn't exist, but they did. In fact, if anybody would have shot a gun on November 9th, the whole story could have taken another outcome. And I think we were so extremely lucky that this didn't happen. The Germans behaved very orderly, and even the East German Army behaved orderly, but most important, that Gorbachev had said, no tanks, we will send no tanks if anything is going to happen. This was the most important announcement, and this actually cleared the way for everything that happened afterwards. I even think we could have had two Germanys afterwards, maybe to the very day. History has taken a very fortunate course for the Germans, and as far as Germans can be happy, I think we are fairly happy. And we were never better off in our history than now.
Peter Schneider, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Peter Schneider, a former leader of the student protest movement in Berlin, now the George M. Roth Distinguished Writer in Residence at Georgetown University, the author of many novels, and, well, it's our pleasure to have him with us today. But let's go to another with long experience in this, Joseph Jaffe, publisher, editor of Die Zeit. He's a senior fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies, of course, in Germany when the Berlin Wall went up and then when it came down. He wrote about both those events in a piece for the Washington Post, which you can find on our website. Joseph Jaffe with us today by phone from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi there. I'm looking out at a Berlin Wall here on the campus, made from wood and plywood. And that brings back not such fond memories.
A replica of the Berlin Wall,
yes.
I remember National Public Radio. I was London bureau chief in the years just before this, and National Public Radio had a tight budget. I think that persists to this day. But we used to, when we would travel in the Eastern Bloc, we would fly into Tempelhof in Berlin and then schlep our equipment across through the checkpoint and then go to Schönefeld in East Germany and get the cheap East German flights to Moscow.
And the stuff was a lot heavier then than it is with mini camps today.
I remember walking through the checkpoint in a snowstorm with Deborah Amos, my producer. We were on our way to Poland to interview Lech Wałęsa and wondering why I was walking in this direction.
No more war stories like that.
Okay. There was an element. Did you perceive the Berlin Wall as something
no.
that was permanent?
No. I mean, look, even if you had yes. If you'd asked me even in October of 1989, is the wall going to come down? Is the GDR going to disappear? Let alone, is the Soviet Empire going to disappear? I would have said, no, this situation is forever. So, and I think that pretty much reflected the thinking of most of the chattering classes, not only in Germany, but also in Europe.
And we were all wrong.
We were all wrong, which just shows you it's good that we only write for the day, as it were, and that the stuff that we print on becomes wrapping paper tomorrow.
You also wrote, interestingly, in the piece in the Washington Post that there's an element of nostalgia for the old days among some in Germany, even to this day.
Well, some means a kind of sense of nostalgia the way the Israelites had a nostalgia for the flesh pots of Egypt. If you look back 20 years, everything acquires a halo, and it was such a wonderful protective state, and there was no joblessness, and everybody had a place in daycare. So you tend to idealize the past, and that's why we talk about the flesh pots. What more serious indication, I think, is the most recent national election in Germany, where the post-communist, post-party, the so-called the Left Party, which has grown out of the East German Communist Party, took in quite a big take, about 26% in East Germany, and 12.4% in Germany as a whole. That kind of shows you that the East Germans now have their own party, and that this party plays on the resentment of the market economy, of the liberal state, and works on a program of statism and higher taxes and more redistribution. These are the numbers that indicate that there is one quarter of the voting public in Eastern Germany would kind of remembers East Germany in a very rosy light. So, using my metaphor about the 40 years in the desert and the flesh pots, give it another 20 years, and I think this will have disappeared.
Joseph Jaffe, we know you have an event to go to there in front of that mock Berlin Wall. We appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Joseph Jaffe, the publisher, editor of Die Zeit, with us today on the phone from Miami University, the one in Ohio. Let's get a question from here in the audience, studio audience in Studio 4A.
Hi, my name is Kirsten Ruckless, and I'm from Washington, D.C., but I actually grew up in Hamburg, Germany, and so I was 10 years old when the wall came down. And I remember more the reactions of my parents than my own reaction. And I was watching the news with my mom, and she was crying because she was so happy. And my dad actually told me that we had relatives in the East, which I wasn't aware of until then because we weren't allowed to have contacts with them because the East German government had prohibited that. And so he was so excited that he just drove to the inner German border, which was also opening up just like in Berlin, and was hoping that his cousins would be able to come through, which we later find out they couldn't because they hadn't gotten a car yet, which, the required waiting period in East Germany hadn't passed yet. But my dad was actually pretty worried that it was going to be violent before the wall came down. And so he had to ask get visas from the U.S. Embassy in case we had to leave Germany, in case mm-hmm. there was a civil unrest. And we got the visas on November 9th, 1989. So it's kind of ironic.
Those are collector's items in themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you think that people younger than yourself must have no real recollection of this at all?
Yeah, I have some friends who are younger than myself, and they just know those from history books. But I think it's when the parents, you know, tell stories and you see exhibits and museum exhibits in Germany that it's kept alive really well, and hopefully it'll, you know, be an experience that can be also passed on to other generations.
Here's an email we have from Jim in Raleigh, North Carolina. Please say something about the other areas of Germany separated by the fence that ran for hundreds of miles between the two countries, that inner German border that we were just hearing about. Before the change, one would see peaceful German villages in the distance, villages politically separated from neighbors a few miles away. I am a retired German teacher. The first time I was in Berlin after the wall was 1992 with a group of fellow German teachers. The bus picked us up at the airport and took us to our lodgings in East Berlin. We drove through the Brandenburg Gate. The bus got very silent as we approached the gate, and the group burst into applause as we drove through. The moment still gives me goosebumps. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Let's go to Clayton. Clayton with us from Little Rock in Arkansas.
So I was living in Berlin at that time. I moved over to Berlin in 1988. I was a postdoctoral fellow at Max Planck Institute, and I was down at Brandenburger Gate the night it opened. And something that people haven't mentioned is that, in fact, they are right. It was a little more organized than that. They actually had, at the time, I think, if I remember right, the wall was impassable to people who lived in Berlin. But West Germans could go in.
Mm-hmm.
That flipped around once they decided they were going to start taking the wall down, and they let Berliners in, West Berliners, into East Berlin. Now, I had an actual living permit. I lived there as a German. And so one of the questions I asked is, what about the people who live there with living permits? And they said, okay, we'll let them in too. And actually, I went over to East Berlin two or three, maybe a week, week and a half before the wall even came down. We were passing in and out, back and forth across the wall.
And so this was our recollection of this. It was a permeable barrier, but nevertheless highly restricted for those people in East Berlin who wanted to get out before November 9th.
Yeah, and what they were doing is, if I remember right, they were actually still letting some of the East Berliners come across too, but they could only go in and out of Berlin.
Right.
And so what people didn't understand, I didn't understand when I moved to Berlin at that time, was that I always thought Berlin was sitting right on the west and east border, which a lot of people did.
No, it was an island. It was an enclave.
It was right in the middle of East Germany. So you had to go through the transit roads, and then you had to go in through the transit gates to go into West Berlin. So even if the East Berliners came back over to west, they couldn't get back out again because they'd have to go back across the transit gates to get across back into East Berlin. Mm-hmm. So all they could do is go back and forth to West Berlin. So it was like a week or some, I can't remember exact amount of time, but people were going back and forth and transiting through. You had to go down to the East German office down in West Berlin and get a visa, and they would stamp it in your book or give you, I think if I remember, they stamped something in your passport. And then you would actually go through these checkpoints in the wall, and you go into East Berlin, and you could passage into parts of East Germany that were outside of Berlin.
All right, Clayton, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. We're talking 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Were you there? Eyewitness to History. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News. And one person who was an eyewitness, Carol Guzzi, who's been very patient with us here in the studio in Washington, D.C., as she's listened to other people talk about their recollections. You were there taking pictures for the Washington Post. I wonder, you talked about that wow moment. You have the pictures that you took that day that I'm sure you've got on a gallery on your computer and other places too now. But I wonder, what other what memory do you have? Did you come away with a souvenir?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I have a whole box full of pieces of the Berlin Wall. And a heart made from the barbed wire of the Iron Curtain. It's they're cherished treasures to me now, of course. And it's interesting because the pieces of the wall from the east side are completely blank and austere, and you have all the colors of the graffiti from the west side. And also my personal memories. I mean, there was a street party one night where East and West Berliners were dancing, and it was kind of like out of a movie set. And I believe the song was Tracy Chapman's talking about a revolution. And it was just so amazingly cool to be there.
I bet it was. There's somebody here in the studio audience in Studio 4A.
My name is Claudia Vess, and I saw the wall in August of 2009, and at that time, many parts of the wall had already been moved, so you could walk freely through that space that was between the two parts mm-hmm. of the wall. And I just want to say, since I've seen that area since then, and you can hardly tell where that space is now, but then, even in August, that space was a totally dead space. You would walk from the west, where the air was moving, where you felt like there was life, and as soon as you stepped over the mark, that space was absolutely dead. And when you walked to the east, people there looked at Westerners in a sort of strange way. It was an incredible experience.
In those days, it's hard to remember. You could instantly tell someone from the east or the west by the clothes they wore.
Yes, you could.
Interesting. Let's see. We get one more caller on the line. This is Aaron. Aaron with us from Monterey in California.
Hi there.
Hi, Aaron.
I was working in southern Germany down in Heidelberg, but running the abroad program. And each year we took the students to Berlin in November for a week studying East-West German relations. And so we had been there for a week with 50 19-year-old students, talking about that demonstration on November 4th and the implications for what's going to be happening in the next few months or few years, and then came back from a late dinner to the hotel, and here are my students running through the hall saying, "The wall's down, the wall's down." So we all just went out to the wall. And the woman who was talking about the music, one of my strongest recollections was hearing somebody playing the Beach Boys and hearing a bunch of normally very reserved Germans singing Surfen auf dem Mauer. So it was a wild night. We were there talking about going through that transit area. We got stuck. We left on the 11th. And I had 50 19-year-olds on a double-decker bus, and we were stuck in a 12-hour traffic jam trying to get out of East Germany and into West Germany.
Again, Berlin was an enclave inside East Germany, so you had
yes.
to drive through more of East Germany before you got back to the West. Thank you very much for that recollection, Aaron. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. And I'd like to thank everybody who called in today and wrote us. We're sorry we couldn't get to you all. And, thank you very much again for your recollections of the fall of the wall. We'd also like to thank Carol Guzzi, a staff photographer for the Washington Post. And again, you can see pictures of her at the wall that day at our website. Go to npr.org, where there's plenty more about this 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.